Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, OK, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defence ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster. And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On the anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri reminded the nation of Sadr's legacy, stressing that the only way out of any crisis is unity among Lebanese people. Berri called on all parliamentary blocs to participate in a seven-day dialogue in Parliament, after which there would be open-ended sessions to elect a president.
Dear Lebanese, exactly 1 year has passed since my call on the parliamentary blocs on the need to realize a national agreement by electing a president who unites and does not divide, a president who is supported by the Christians, but also by Muslims, and who is before all this a nationalist. Such an accomplishment could assist Lebanon in exiting its economic crisis.
45 years after his disappearance, Imam al-Sadr is still seen as the main founder of resistance against the Israeli occupation, while also representing unity among the Lebanese people.
The legacy of Imam Musa Sadr did not only not die, but it overgrows all the periods of Lebanon. And every time we have a crisis, we remember that only his teachings and what he was calling for can represent the salvation for this country.
This is a very sad day for us. Had Imam Sadr been alive today, we would not have had all these problems we are seeing today. We would not have had these political, economic, or social problems. But we promised him that we will continue his path.
Imam Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal Hope movement in 1974 and openly worked for the rights of the oppressed and the lower class in Lebanon.
Musa Sadr, the Lebanese Imam, represents all what does Lebanon represent. The unity, the ableness of living together, Muslims and Christians, the willingness not to surrender in front of evil. That's what Musa Sadr represents. They intended by kidnapping him to erase all his existence. His existence continued.
It's an opportunity for the Lebanese to remember what the Imam Sadr stands for as far as unity and peace and one country united for its own people.
The prominent Shiite cleric disappeared on August 31, 1978, during an official visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Lebanon still holds former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi responsible for his disappearance, along with two of his companions, while blaming the Libyan authorities for concealing details which could uncover the fate of Sadr.
45 years on, and the case of Musa Sadr's disappearance remains unclosed. The people of Lebanon unanimously believe that this is not a lost cause, for his legacy and the values of resistance and justice which he fought for have not died down. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars, and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent, and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies.
Iranian officials and the scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The United States is on a record annual pace for mass shootings, averaging two such incidents every day this year. High summer temperatures, soaring economic inequality, a nation awash in guns and with lax supervision over them, there seems to be a universal belief that the epidemic of mass shootings won't decline anytime soon. But there is increasing anger over which mass shootings get political attention and which do not. Every day, 120 Americans are killed with guns, and more than 200 are shot and wounded. But the recent murder of three black people in Florida by a white racist was immediately seized upon by the political classes, even though domestic far-right extremists killed just 25 people last year.
As I made clear in my inaugural address, white supremacy is a poison. It's a poison. It's been allowed to grow faster and fester in our communities. to the point where the intelligence community is determined, the U.S. intelligence community is determined that domestic terrorism rooted in white supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat we face in the homeland.
Shootings at schools also get massive attention, but what goes repeatedly ignored are the victims at the most common site of debilitating gun violence, poor neighborhoods.
It's a tragedy when these things are happening, but when those things happen, they usually happen in these white schools and these rich neighborhoods. They're getting funding, they're getting support, the media is talking about it, the world cares about gun safety. But we're talking about it on a daily basis and no one cares. I had a 13-year-old say, I carry a gun to school because I want to make it there safely, not because I want to hurt somebody. I think that speaks volume for a 13-year-old to be able to say something like that. And I think those are the situations and stories that need to be told, and those are the ones that need to be invested in, and how are we able to make that shift and make that happen?
Gun control is a constant media topic, but there is almost no discussion about the economic and social redistribution programs which have been proven to reduce mass shootings in poor areas.
The investment is not going in the right spaces. They invest so much, so heavily on the policing aspect of it, and they've done that for decades, and it's repeatedly proven to not work or make a difference. Building community together, getting God up to there, they never seen, taking them off the block, taking them other spaces, and investing that money and putting money in their pockets and teaching them skills at the same time. And that's the aspect and component that's missing.
The U.S. gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Their economic inequality is the highest of any nation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the so-called Club of Rich Countries. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Almost 3 years after he was given the all-clear by pharmacy regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council, pro-Palestine activist Nazim Ali's fitness to pursue his career as a pharmacist is being questioned again by the same regulator.
A tribunal at the regulator's headquarters here in Canary Wharf, East London, has been tasked with establishing whether or not Mr. Ali's words, such as Zionists are not Jews, which he spoke at a 2017 Al-Quds rally in the British capital, were, quote, objectively anti-Semitic.
The hearing was pushed for by what's collectively known as the Zionist lobby in the UK, pro-Israeli organizations with a penchant for going after pro-Palestine activists.
It's a deliberate sort of attempt at conflating and making the water muddy, as it were, that distinction between anti-Semitism and sort of anti-Zionism or anti-Israel speech. And they're deliberately sort of muddying the water. They're using the IHRA definition, and they're sort of throwing as much as they can to confuse things. And it's a way of sort of silencing speech.
Nazim Ali, a pharmacist of some 30 years, is but one example of how the Zionist lobby weaponizes anti-Semitism to silence critics of Israel. Other recent examples are former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, the rapper Lowkey, and Bristol University professor David Miller. Also present at the hearing, Mr. Ali's family, who have experienced his ordeal with him every step of the way for the past 6 years.
Well, it most certainly hasn't been easy when you see your father plastered over different news outlets online and in print media with headlines and photos that aren't the most flattering, that represent him in a very negative light. I can't go on the record and say that people are lying, per se, but certainly there are many falsities that are out there that have been published against him that cause a lot of frustration. And one day we hope that justice will be served, not only in the courts, but also in the public eye as well.
Just a song? No, you mentioned the word bomb.
Also known for his sharp wit and his stand-up comedy that challenges Muslim stereotypes and anti-Muslim tropes, Mr. Ali took to social media before the hearing, asking his supporters to pray for him to succeed in putting the case against him to rest once and for all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A global campaign has been launched by humanitarian activists calling for a lifting of the blockade on Sana'a International Airport. The airport was forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition shortly after its invasion on Yemen in 2015. The signing of a ceasefire agreement deal with the Saudi-led coalition last year was supposed to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni patients. But in effect, nothing has changed for those in need of medical treatment.
According to reports, nearly 8,000 sick Yemenis have passed away during the ceasefire because they were not able to fly out of the country in time to get proper medical treatment. Medical health officials are calling the closure of Sana'a Airport a grave public health tragedy.
And that's because more sick Yemenis will continue to die if they are unable to fly out for life-saving medical treatment.
We launched this campaign with both Yemeni and non-Yemeni activists to make it clear that Sana'a Airport remains besieged. Only three flights consisting of 700 passengers are allowed a week. Before the aggression, that number was 6,000 passengers a week. There are many sick patients who need to fly out of the country for immediate medical treatment. Currently, there are 30,000 sick patients unable to fly out of the country because of this blockade.
The campaign to open Sana'a Airport has attracted much support from human rights and anti-war activists worldwide, demanding an end to the blockade.
From Canada, we join our voice to people in Yemen and all over the world that are condemning and denouncing the continued U.S.-Saudi-Emirati aggression and blockade against the people of Yemen. The U.S.-backed, Saudi-led bombing campaign and war on Yemen for over 8 years have destroyed hospitals, healthcare infrastructure. Thousands today in Yemen cannot access medical care. Thousands are waiting to be able to travel outside of Yemen to access that medical care.
Today, Yemen needs to rebuild. Yemen needs access to healthcare. For that, this blockade needs to be lifted immediately. The land, air, and sea blockade needs to be lifted so that the people of Yemen can have access to medical supplies and supplies needed to rebuild their country.
According to reports, an estimated 120,000 Yemenis have died as a direct result of the closure of Sana'a Airport. Many of those patients are dialysis patients who were not able to get the kidney transplants available only abroad. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Boasting the highlights of his presidency, in the third press conference held during his tenure, President Ebrahim Raisi put the spotlight on successful efforts made over the past 2 years to expand foreign relations, pointing out that enemies have failed to isolate Iran and drive the nation into despair. The Iranian president stressed that Tehran has managed to forge strong relations with Islamic and like-minded countries.
We've expanded our foreign ties and improved the level of political and economic relations. Our commercial ties have grown 14% compared to the previous government. These achievements have been made while the enemy has tried to follow two strategies of isolating Iran in the world and disappointing the people inside the country, which it failed in both.
President Raisi's administration has been following numerous agendas in Iran foreign policy, the most important of which is the JCPOA and the removal of sanctions. But at the same time, Tehran has also been able to gain a foothold in the political equations in the region and beyond by obtaining memberships in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS.
Alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS are definitely effective against U.S. unilateralism. Our membership in these organizations shows that the enemy did not succeed in his policy to isolate Iran, and our political, commercial, and economic situation shows that the enemy has failed in this strategy.
But the highlight of the administration's efforts is the stronger relations it has forged with regional countries and the resumption of ties with Saudi Arabia in particular.
Iran has made great achievements as far as foreign policy is concerned, and according to the president, it will be taking more steps to expand its foreign relations. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
WIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Visiting Lebanon, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says that Tehran is ready to help Lebanon end its energy crisis. Tehran has also offered to assist Syria in reconstruction of the country. This is despite numerous sanctions imposed on Iran by U.S.-led Western countries that claim these bans are because of Iran's destabilizing actions. But what are these destabilizing actions? Is it Iran's contribution to the defeat of Daesh terror group in the region? Is it Iran's support for oppressed peoples of the region? Or is it Iran's fight against spread of narcotics in the region? Or is it Iran's efforts to root out foreign interference in regional issues? Let's see what our guests have to say about that. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have historian and journalist Breck Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. And joining us from Houston, Texas, we have human rights activist Mohsen Nabi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Jonkers from Hasselt. Sir, the U.S. and co. accuse Iran of destabilizing actions in the region. This is while Tehran has expressed readiness to help Lebanon end its energy crisis, has assisted in reconstruction efforts in Syria, and has been calling for countries in the region to be more unified in providing security for the region. Are these destabilizing actions, in your opinion, or just actions that Washington and its allies are not happy with?
Well, they are surely actions that destabilize the plans that exist in the halls of Washington, D.C., Tel Aviv, London, and Paris, and other places in which the Western imperialist powers are, of course, plotting from and where they make their plans for what they want to do to the Middle East. This has been going on since, at the very least, the beginning of the 21st century, and especially after the 9/11 attacks, in which the Americans were really putting their plans into motion to create what they called the Greater Middle East Project in order to take over control of the entire area. So when the Iranian Islamic Republic has helped significantly in destroy the Daesh terrorists, when Iran has stood by the Syrian Arab Republic, stood by Lebanon, stood by the Palestinian cause, and stood in general by the entire Islamic region and the Islamic world, and particularly that in West Asia, which is a crucially important strategic region for U.S. And Zionist imperialist designs. This, of course, is for United States perspective, from an American imperialist perspective, this destabilizes the plans that they already had. So that is basically what it comes down to. It's all a matter of perspective in this case. The United States claims that Iran is a destabilizing factor, while Iran has never really attacked the country since the Islamic Revolution. Iran has never overthrown a government in its entire history. And they are not planning, as far as anything points out, to ever do so. Whereas the United States, of course, has overthrown governments in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Libya, and have tried to do the same thing in Syria. And they have bumped into significant resistance from the local population, from the Iraqis, from the Syrians, but also from allies in the region, considering in this case, most particularly, the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's the major reason, I think, why they have such a hatred of Iran at this moment.
Mohsen Naghvi, the U.S. constantly demonizes Iran's quote-unquote regional activities. Iran has responded in the past, saying that the U.S. has sealed the highest number of arms sales deals, signed many military and defense cooperation agreements in the region, and its plentiful military bases jeopardize regional peace and stability. By the looks of it, the U.S. could be the real destabilizing factor in the region. How can an extra-regional player like the U.S. make such accusations
about Iran and about interregional stability?
Well, the U.S. Doesn't really stand or have any kind of a moral leeway to comment on the actions of the Islamic Republic. It's a matter of fact that as soon as Iran intervened into Syria, we now see peace in Syria. We don't see Daesh in Syria anymore. As soon as Iran enters the field in Iraq, we see the extermination of Daesh there. With Iran's diplomacy today and Iran's ties with Saudi Arabia, we see peace in Yemen now. It is because of Iran's actions that Iraq now hosts one of the largest pilgrimages in the world. The Arbaeen Walk, the Arbaeen Procession, is hosted by Iraq because of the efforts that the Islamic Republic has made in this region. It is because of the intervention of Iran, and it is because of the diplomatic efforts of Iran that we somewhat see a somewhat stable government in Afghanistan. And on the contrary, it is the mess, the atrocities, the oppression of the U.S. government, of U.S. diplomacy, of U.S. foreign policy that Iran has corrected, not by the means of weapons, but by the means of self-defense and by the means of diplomacy. And unfortunately, it is these actions that has affected the so-called plan of the U.S. empire to provide security to the Zionist regime, failing. We see that every single plan that the U.S. government had outside of its borders in terms of its influence and in terms of its domination in West Asia, it is the Islamic Republic that has been sanctioned since the revolution by the Western Empire. It has been sanctioned, and yet it managed to defeat the policies, the atrocious policies of the U.S. empire in this region. This is a matter of fact that everyone sees with their own eyes. No matter what concocted statistics that the Western Empire presents before the world, it is a mere lie. So if anything, the Islamic Republic has been a source of peace in this region, and it has been an actor that has empowered its allies and doesn't dominate its allies, unlike the U.S. empire.
Sure. Brecht Yonkers, one of the most evident contributions Iran made to stability in the region was the battle against Daesh, and how Iran, with its anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, battled Daesh in Iraq to neutralize the Takfiri terrorists. Talk to us about the pivotal role Iran played during the battle against Daesh.
I think this can never be overstated, how important the Iranian efforts were in rooting out Daesh. Of course, we can never forget about the efforts by the Iraqis and the Syrians themselves, as well as the support by countries such as Russia to this battle. But Iran has played an absolutely pivotal role, and most importantly, Shahid Qasem Soleimani, of course, in this struggle. In fact, we know now from intelligence reports and from eventually from reports that have been revealed that even things such as the Russian intervention, the Russian support, increased Russian support to the Syrian Arab Republic for a significant part was the doing of Shahid Soleimani himself as well, who was in contact with various foreign partners in order to try to support the Syrian Arab Republic and the Republic of Iraq against the scourge of Daesh, Takfiri, Wahhabism. So it is something that it is almost unimaginable now, seeing the relative stability of countries such as Syria and Iraq in a certain way as well. It is even unimaginable now to think about the fact that just years ago, less than a decade ago, there was an actual period in which the complete and total collapse of both Syria and Iraq and the existence of these two countries as countries in and of themselves was at risk. There was a very great and grave chance that Syria and Iraq would basically cease existing. Their border was already completely obliterated by the fact that Daesh controlled both sides of it as part of their falsely declared so-called caliphate. And these Daesh terrorists, they controlled both Syrian and Iraqi land, as well as a significant chunk of their population, which they kept as de facto slaves, as well as, of course, the natural resources that abound in both countries. So when you see all these things happening less than 10 years ago, the rollback and the destruction of this Wahhabi scourge is almost you can basically call it nothing short of a miracle. And the significant pillar of this miracle was, of course, worked by the forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, most importantly, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Al-Quds Force, and just in general, the massive amount of support that was given to Syria and to Iraq in particular in order to destroy this. This is one of the major events of the 21st century so far, one of the major events maybe of the past half century or longer in the West Asian region, is the defeat of Daesh. And with the defeat of Daesh comes the defeat of the latest plot that was concocted in the halls of Washington and Tel Aviv, because after it turns out that they could not just overthrow governments and place pawns and puppets in charge, which was the original plan around 2001, the American Zionist Empire decided to basically use a new strategy. And that strategy was a strategy of chaos, okay, the total and utter destruction of the region. And Iran is the country that stopped this.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mohsen Arvi, let's turn our attention to Iran's role in the resistance front and its support for Palestine. Just recently, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who's in Lebanon, reiterated Tehran's support for the Palestinian cause, saying Palestine's liberation is the central plank of Tehran's foreign policy in the region. Now, for the U.S.-Israeli alliance, that has to be considered destabilizing, as Iran has been firm opposition to Washington and Tel Aviv's machinations and plots for the region.
Absolutely, there's no doubt about that. I think Iran has proven itself to be a player in world politics and in regional politics where their strategies and their plans have been effective. In terms of supporting the resistance, I think the one source of resistance against the policies of the Americans has been the formation of the axis of resistance, the resistance front, the true resistance front, in which we see Hezbollah as a key player in defeating the so-called Zionist regime. And it was after the defeat in 2006 when Sayyid Nasrallah deemed the Zionist regime as the spider's web, that Israel is as weak as the spider's web. This understanding that the world had that Israel is undefeated, that this small military power like the Zionist regime could rule over the entire region. First in 2000 and then in 2006, Hezbollah managed to absolutely obliterate any such perceptions that the world had. That was that first and second victory. And then we see that this sense of resistance that Hezbollah started off with, and that was also seen before Hezbollah, it was also seen by the Sipahi Pasdaran against another American puppet, Saddam Hussein, who was funded, placed, and financed by the U.S. government. Saddam Hussein was also defeated in the famous war, which is called the Dafa Muqaddasa, in which the Islamic Republic defeated Saddam Hussein in war. We see the resistance then expanding over to supporting Hamas.
Okay, let's cross over to Mr. Yonkers once again. Mr. Narvi, we're experiencing some technical difficulties there, but while we figure that out, I want to address a question to Mr. Yonkers. President Raisi's foreign policy has been based on cooperation with all countries, with an emphasis on a look to the east. We know that Iran will be joining BRICS officially at the start of next year. Iran was recently ratified as a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Is it safe to say that the maximum pressure campaign enacted by the U.S. and attempts by Washington and its allies in isolating Iran has not worked?
I think it's definitely a correct assessment to say that. And in fact, this has actually happened several times before and with several countries that the United States tried to put maximum pressure on. It's a strategy that they have started honing back in the, at least as far back as the beginning of the Cold War. And very often it has worked, but very often it has led to increased resentment of the United States and the country that they are sanctioning and that they are targeting and trying to punish. And has in fact then led to that said country moving further and further away from any possibility of being influenced by the United States. And we have seen this as well with the Islamic Republic of Iran. I don't need to tell you that there have definitely been times and periods in which Iran was very much open to negotiation. And even now they always keep the door at a certain point still open for further talks with the United States. But the United States, both the Democrats and the Republicans, they are constantly trying to outbid and outdo each other in hawkish attitude and an attitude of trying to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran. And one thing in which they have severely miscalculated is that, especially since last year, especially since the beginning of the of 2022, we are speaking now of a world that is truly becoming multipolar and no longer the unipolar U.S.-dominated world that existed at least since 1991 at the end of the Cold War. We are now existing in a world in which several countries, even when they don't agree with each other politically, they are willing to come together and negotiate in order for their own mutual benefit and no longer take dictates on commands just from whatever imperialist power tries to dictate them in many cases. That is either the United States or the United Kingdom. So that's why Iran has now grasped an opportunity to really use this new multipolar system in order to, for example, carry good relations with and membership with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and that's particularly important on a military point of view, which means good relations with China, good relations with Russia, with a certain extent at the same time with India and Pakistan, within this alliance of sorts, which comes as part of this rise of a Eurasian integration and a Eurasian connection, in which these countries, including Iran, of course, they retain their full sovereignty and their full independence and their full permission to basically conduct their own affairs in any way they see fit within their own borders, but respect each other as potential allies and as partners. And this is something that severely has weakened the grasp and stranglehold of the West on the West Asian region.
And back to Mr. Mohsen Naqvi in Houston, Texas. Just recently, Iran's foreign minister said the normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh is a positive step and will have positive impact in the region. Now, with Saudi Arabia also adding its name to the list of BRICS countries, and of course the recent Chinese-mediated revival of relations with Iran, are countries in the West Asia region slowly moving away from U.S. influence?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that the West Asian countries are moving away from the influence of the U.S. empire, and it is high time that they realize that this is the move forward. When we analyze and see the U.S. alliance means U.S. slavery, means you lose your sovereignty when you ally with the U.S. empire, and we have several examples. One of those main examples is Saudi Arabia itself, and Iran has always had a policy to be in good relations with its neighbors. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And Iran has proven that its relations with Saudi Arabia and that the Islamic Republic, when it initiated the normalization of ties with Saudi Arabia, they proved that when they said that they want good relations with all their neighbors, they weren't bluffing. It's as a matter of fact. And this move that the Chinese helped negotiate, it also solved one of the biggest crises in the history of West Asia, which is the Saudi atrocities and the Saudi war upon the Yemeni people. Even that issue was solved. And I think it is after the resolution of the Yemeni war that now we truly see that the influence of U.S. foreign policy, we see that it will eventually become non-existential with BRICS, with the influence, with the economic, diplomatic, and political influence that the Islamic Republic has in this region. I think definitely there's no doubt that the region will move away from Western domination and truly become sovereign in its right.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Historian and journalist Breck Jonkers from Hasselt, Belgium, and human rights activist Mohsen Arvi joining us from Houston, Texas. Thank you for contributing to the program, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. and the EU can't countenance an international order that they don't lead, while Russia and China are striving to build a fair and just order where all countries are equal regardless of their size. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, St. Petersburg hosted the second Russia-Africa summit from July 27th to 28th that was attended by 17 heads of state from that continent. They and other participants, which also included five vice presidents and four heads of government alongside many national delegations, bravely defied Western pressure to come to this event. Russian officials earlier claimed that the U.S. and the EU were trying to talk their guests out of going. This allegation was lent credence by the publication of hostile Western media editorials. The overwhelming majority of African countries participated in some capacity after only five countries declined to send representatives to the summit. Western political and media pressure failed to ruin the event because African countries appreciate the ways in which Russia can help them strengthen their sovereignty during these unpredictable times. The West anti-Russian sanctions that were imposed after the start of its special operation in Ukraine caused problems for its African partners, which weren't resolved in spite of the Black Sea Grain Initiative that Moscow recently declined to extend after it accused the West of not fulfilling its part of the deal. Nevertheless, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised during the latest summit to ship the neediest of them grain free of charge by year's end. This brings the analysis around to discussing other aspects of the event since it concerned more than just strengthening Russian-African agricultural cooperation. Consistent with the theme of peace, security and development, military ties were discussed bilaterally with interested countries behind closed doors, but the details weren't publicly disclosed due to their sensitivity. Additionally, academic, energy, financial, industrial, institutional, media, and other forms of cooperation were also discussed. What connects everything together is that the comprehensive expansion of Russian-African relations in each of these spheres advances President Putin's vision of helping his country's partners on the continent strengthen national and cultural sovereignty like he pledged to do leading up to the summit. He has regularly spoken about this concept since the start of the special operation, which he considers to be the prerequisite for mutually beneficial partnerships. It deserves to be mentioned at this point that not a single African country jumped on the West anti-Russian sanctions bandwagon despite immense pressure to do so. This includes those who voted against it at least once at the UNGA. Never before had all of Africa come together like this. Its countries clearly wanted to show the international community that they are truly independent and will no longer let their former colonizers dictate their policies. The West was shocked by this unprecedented display of sovereignty, which is why its officials and media began waging an information warfare campaign against Russia in a desperate attempt to convince African countries to sanction it. Examples include false claims that its military advisors are responsible for atrocities and lying that Russia is weaponizing famine in Africa. No African country was swayed into sanctioning Russia, however, not even those that didn't attend the latest summit. They all know that their objective national interests are best served by keeping their strategic options open and not burning bridges with any of their partners, no matter the external pressure put upon them. Russia is regarded as a historically reliable partner with whom ties can be expanded in whatever sphere any given African country wants, which can help diversify from their previously disproportionate dependence on the West while complementing their efforts to cultivate even closer ties with China. Russia doesn't attach strings to its agricultural and military aid, nor does China attach any to its infrastructure investments and market access, with these forms of cooperation combining to strengthen African state sovereignty. Moreover, these major countries are also sincere in their desire to improve people-to-people ties, especially academic exchanges and skills training. The reason for this is that they envisage Africa as a whole functioning as an independent pole in the emerging multipolar world order. Therein lies the primary difference between the US and the EU on one hand, and Russia and China on the other. The first pair attaches strings of some sort of all forms of aid in order to keep Africa subordinated to them, while the second pair never attaches any of the aforesaid since it wants to empower Africa's rise. This insight enables one to better understand the significance of the second Russia-Africa summit, which is intended to function as Russia's complementary version of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Both events take place at multi-year intervals, thus providing enough time to make progress on their action plans. Although Russia is comparatively late in re-engaging with Africa, it more than makes up for this delay with the strategic role that it plays in ensuring its partners' agricultural and military needs.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is Iran.